From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. GM, Ford, and Chrysler kick in $26 million to Detroit's grand bargain.
They got a helping hand when they needed it, and I think now there's sort of a subtle but persistent expectation that, especially in Detroit, they're going to step up and do the right thing.
Plus, latest statistics offer hope that crime in Detroit is lessening, but
I think we need better prevention. We do not have enough police in Detroit. Yeah. And I think that's just a fact.
The frustrating catch-22 for homeless Michiganders who can't get state ID.
How we handle and take care of those that have the greatest need defines us. As a society, this is something that should not be tolerated.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Picture an alley, and you probably think of a rundown, grimy, narrow pathway between old urban buildings. But in urban areas across the country, that picture is changing. Urban alleys are becoming microcosms for urban redevelopment. Today on Stateside, we will hear how Detroit is no exception. And then later in the hour, we find out what is keeping some homeless people in Michigan from accessing the services they need. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for joining us. First today, Ford, General Motors, and the Chrysler Group. They all know a thing or two about perilous times and near-death experiences. Today, they offered a $26 million helping hand to the Detroit Institute of Arts. Michigan Radio's Detroit reporter Sarah Swick joins us with more. What did we hear from the automakers today, and how will this commitment work?
Well, they're going to be making some pretty big financial commitments to, as you said, the grand bargain. That's the pot of money that is, simply put, supposed to minimize losses to Detroit city pensioners in bankruptcy while at the same time protecting the arts assets. The museum's assets, so it doesn't potentially get sold off to creditors. And Ford and GM, through their charitable foundations, are both contributing $10 million. And then Chrysler Group is also contributing $6 million. So that's $26 million overall.
And how will this work? Will they get a great big, pot of money? Here you go. Money up front. Will it be spread out?
I don't think they're totally sure about that yet. I think there's some leeway in terms of how the money is going to be given to the DIA and over what period of time. And I think the DIA is supposed to be raising a larger amount of money, $100 million, its own contribution toward the grand bargain. And it's still not clear at this point whether that money is going to be paid up front as a lump sum or whether it's going to be paid over 20 years.
So in essence, the automakers are kicking in about a quarter of the DIA's share of the grand bargain.
Yeah, exactly. And we learned today that the DIA said they've secured commitments for about $70 million. So they're a good portion of the way toward their $100 million goal. But I think this was also a way to say to especially members of the Detroit corporate community to say, we're still looking for money.
What do you guess is the reason? What's the sense of the reason the automakers are jumping into the grand bargain?
I think there's a sense, obviously, looking at particularly GM and Chrysler, but all the Detroit automakers, that they got a helping hand when they needed it. And I think now there's sort of a subtle but persistent expectation that, especially in Detroit, they're going to step up and do the right thing. I think the DIA, I'd seen some reports that the DIA had actually hoped they would chip in a bit more money, but I think, in essence, they had to do something. The other thing is that both the automakers, Detroit's automakers, and Detroit's auto families, the Fords and so on, have been big patrons of the DIA historically. Many of the pieces have been contributed by families or in entire wings of the museum, I think, are, at least partially sponsored by something affiliated with one of the automakers. So they have a long history also of supporting the DIA. And I think this is part of that tradition.
So it's history. And it does sound like some of it is PR, as the automakers certainly want to be part of the narrative of saving the DIA and keeping those pensioners from the deeper cuts that they would have suffered without the grand bargain.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think both of those things are a big part of this.
And, of course, knowing that the pensioners are voting right now on whether they will accept the grand bargain, is there a sense that this will have a influence, or do the pensioners really care if the automakers jump in?
It's really hard to tell how this whole process is going to go in terms of influencing the minds of the pensioners to to approve the grand bargain, which they need to do as a creditor class to for the grand bargain to actually work out and, you know, this whole deal to go into place. I've seen things on social media, talked to a number of retirees, and I've really gotten mixed sentiments so far about, I mean, obviously no one's happy about having to vote to take cuts, however relatively small compared to what had been talked about previously. But yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely a concerted effort to put the pressure on retirees to vote yes to the grand bargain. Whether that will have any effect, I honestly can't tell you at this point.
Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick reporting on today's announcement that General Motors, Ford, and the Chrysler Group will be kicking in a combined $26 million to the DIA's $100 million contribution to the grand bargain. Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Violent crime has dropped in Detroit. Even though shootings and aggravated assaults are starting to climb, Detroit police crime statistics show year-to-date there has been a 9% decrease in violent crimes from the same time last year. Carl Taylor is a Michigan State University sociology professor, a native Detroiter, and a nationally prominent urban scholar. Good to have you back on Stateside, Carl.
Thank you for having me.
Well, here we have violent crime down 15% in the first quarter, property crime down 28%. What do you think is behind this?
Well, it's really kind of puzzling because when you say that historically or even in the last decade, that's not the way it feels in many of the neighborhoods that we are out in with our field team.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's the question is, does it feel safer? And we know it's still very dangerous. So statistics go up and down, and they don't always reflect what is going on. We've even had the conflict. I wouldn't say the conflict, but the prosecutor's office at the time, I talked about, you know, reporting crime. But I know for a fact, and when we're out in the field, that a lot of crime goes unreported. So in lieu of that, you're saying that, and I hear what you're saying, but we've also had in the last couple of months a tremendous backlash from shooting people, breaking in people's homes like never before.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how that all smooths out, you know?
Well, you know, in fact, I want to get your thoughts on Detroit's police chief, James Craig. We know he came in last summer and made a lot of changes as far as moving officers from desk jobs to road patrols and, you know, getting rid of those hated 12-hour shifts that were wrecking morale. He got rid of those virtual precincts and reopened precincts. But he was very public earlier this year in stating his belief that he thinks having more guns in the hands of good citizens could deter violent crime. I wondered what your thoughts were on those comments.
Well, first of all, with all due respect to the chief, I don't know him. And I'm not certain that it's fair for anyone or anything to expect a tremendous change in something that's been going on for quite some time. I'm really reluctant, but I will give you my take on.
Mm-hmm.
I've gotten a lot of really tough blogs, and some of it just, you know, rather hateful. I don't think the debate is about at all about citizens arming themselves. I think that that's a question that is answered. Of course you should defend your home, and of course you have the right to defend your home. What I'm looking at is the fallout, and I still think strongly that prevention is better.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe, with all respect again to this police chief, that the real question for the citizens of Detroit and for the professional police officers is that we don't have enough police. So it doesn't matter. This is not a movie. We can't expect for so much. But prevention is really the key, and prevention comes out in different forms. Stronger schools, and, you know, some people don't want to hear this, but jobs play a significant role.
Sure.
Jobs are so important both for adults, for families, and for juveniles. And we're talking about mental health, that I think that politicians need to rethink some things, and it becomes very much a political football. So I think we need better prevention. We do not have enough police in Detroit,
And
I think that's just a fact.
At the same time, circling back to what we began with, it can't be a bad thing to see crime going down. As you say, it's prevalent. It's there. At least it's a trend that's welcome, as opposed to going up.
Oh, absolutely. And I commend the chief and the men and women who are out there working. Their job is not an easy task. They need to be well paid. And people don't always understand that. And when you look, you know this yourself. I look at them. The tremendous job that's taking place in the downtown area, in Midtown. Chief Anthony Holt over there at Wayne State has done a tremendous drop. If I'm not making an error, I think he has a tremendous, like, 34% drop. But he has a very strong department working with the DMC security staff. Mm-hmm. It can be done. You know, we got to have the citizens, we have to have the resources, and we have to have attitudinal change. We're not having that. You know, people have to be responsible for what they're doing, and I'm not seeing that. And we need to go there. We need to train and re-educate or educate. You know, many times people talk about rehabilitation. You cannot rehabilitate something that has not been habilitated. Do you understand? A lot of times we take things for granted. Those of us who have maybe been poor at one point and have because of a good education, we forget sometimes. We look at people and they're poor and they're ignorant, and then we damn them. That's what we do. We may not do it intentionally, and some of us actually believe that. But we're not going to get any place if we don't become more flexible and understand that everyone is not reading the same playbook. Some people don't have a book. They're just out here. Some of them, unfortunately, are acting just totally uncivilized.
Carl Taylor, Michigan State University sociologist. Thank you, Carl, for talking with us on Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The recent shooting rampage near UC Santa Barbara that claimed the lives of seven people, including the shooter Elliot Rogers, featured Rogers' hate-filled videos and the manifesto expressing a sense of male sexual entitlement that struck a deep chord with women all over the world. Almost immediately after the shootings, women took to Twitter to share their experiences with sexual fear, harassment, and sexual assault. It's called hashtag YesAllWomen. Women sharing thoughts such as, hashtag YesAllWomen because apparently the clothes I wear is a more valid form of consent than the words I say. Or from Amy Mann, the cops who asked me, well, what were you wearing when I reported an attack and attempted rape? Hashtag Yes, all women. We wondered about the thoughts on hashtag Yes, all women from a dad. How should dads be talking to their sons? And how can dads help today's women feel more secure around men? Doug French is co-founder of the Dad 2.0 Summit, and with his ex-wife, he's co-creator of the blog When the Flames Go Up about co-parenting after divorce. Doug, I wondered, what were your thoughts as a man and a dad, as we all heard what Elliot Rogers said and thought about women and the men who were dating them?
It was really several complex things hit me at once. I mean, obviously, as a man, and I think I share the sentiments of lots of men who read these tweets and just basically looked at them aghast, thinking I had no idea. And I didn't, in terms of the kinds of things that that women go through on a daily basis that men just don't experience and don't understand because it's never been part of their experience to walk from your car to your house with your car keys in your fist for fear of an assault. And I think that I felt the same way about that as I felt during the Trayvon Martin aftermath. And people of color were writing about how this is what it's like to feel, you know, when you're judged by the color of your skin. Mm-hmm. And I remember the piece that the Questlove wrote in a New York magazine about how here he is, a 6'2", 300-pound mm-hmm. black man mm-hmm. whose first thought is to, let's not anger or worry people around me into thinking I'm something I'm not.
And so this is what we're hearing with hashtag Yes All Women.
Yeah.
And it seems that so much of this activity, the tweets on hashtag Yes All Women, all center on the fact that no should mean no, and it doesn't. What's going wrong, do you think, in the way that America's boys are growing into men to whom no doesn't mean no?
Well, I think one of the there were two tweets that I saw among the mm-hmm. The stream that resonated with me. One was a series of Rolling Stone covers, and there were pictures of men looking just like normal people staring out the camera, but the women were sexualized. The women were, I mean, Britney Spears was on kind of coyly topless. I forget who the other woman was, but I mean, the women are sexualized and meant to be looked as objects and less as people. And I think that's the images we see are very powerful, and they tend to, you know, in many ways you can talk to your kids as much as possible about this sort of thing. But the thing that trumps that is example and the sheer quantity of examples that they see, the sheer mm-hmm. quantity of the imagery and the the things they see on TV, read about. I mean, that resonates a lot more than a talk over a Coca-Cola can, you know, with your kid, and to discuss like what's going on.
The kinds of things that are, that they're soaking up, clearly. And I think we can all agree, certainly Elliot Rodgers' actions were extreme, horrendously extreme. But can we accept the fact that his rhetoric isn't unique, and it's not hard to hear talk like this at bars or campuses or frat houses? And I'll point to Snapchat founder Evan Spiegel's emails when he was in a fraternity. Those have leaked out, and they were sent when he was an undergraduate at Stanford, proof that it's not unique. I mean, I can't even read the things that were in those emails.
No, it's and it's you look at it, and it, whenever you take a moment to take a look at what's happening, it's hard not to be appalled. Through our normal course of business, we're just trying to get from A to B and get our kids fed and make sure they're loved and respected and cared for. But when you look at what's happening and you see this systemic misogyny, which is learned. And that's where the dads come in, I think. And one of my other favorite tweets was the tweet that said, I started reading less All Women because I have a daughter, but it became more apparent to me it's more important because I have two sons.
So what do you think is happening where these attitudes are being learned? And can a hashtag discussion like this help? Because aren't we preaching to the already converted? I mean, we're all agreeing. We're all agreeing. How do we change things? How do we reach the guy that will make a rape joke and laugh at it?
Well, that's the difficult part. And I think I remember Daniel Tosh, the comedian, did a joke like that. He was like, imagine if this woman was about to be raped right now. What would that be like? And he set all that off several months ago because he was so cavalier about it. And I think that it's hard to shift judgments. I mean, I think the great thing about the greater access to technology is that something like Yes, All Women can make the waves and can make national news like this. But at the same time, the sheer quantity of information to which we have access, our brains can't codify it all. And so we have to simplify it, and we tend to circle the wagons and look at the media outlets that reinforce the beliefs we already have. And I think that's what's contributing a lot to the polarization on so many fronts in our culture, the political, with regard to race, with regard to gender. I think there are certain belief points. It's very difficult, and you see less of it. You see less people reading, or fewer people reading what the other side thinks, and trying to develop nuance and empathy. And that's, I think, where this starts from. This starts from empathy. This starts from recognizing that
compassion.
Just because you can't understand it doesn't mean it's not happening. And that's the long-term discussion to have with your kids, especially if you're a father of sons, to recognize that the overall point is that women, like the one point woman said, like it's safer to give a man a fake phone number than to say no.
Mm.
Right.
I do wonder if overall as a society, are we doing a disservice to boys as they grow into men? I'll say this, for example, a man will make a move toward us, and if we think we're attracted to him, it's sweet. And when he does the very same thing and we don't feel attracted, he's a creep. He's harassing us. Or we tell men we want them to be more sensitive, but then society will make fun of a man for being soft and crying like a girl. It almost seems like when it comes to expressing feelings and emotions, women have a red carpet rolled out. They can do it. Men can't. Is that where some of this is coming from?
I think so. And I think that in general, we are kind of hardwired to judge. And speaking as someone who was a man among women at the playground, and later in life as a single man with children at the playground, you can be – anybody can be judged. But what's happening, what enthuses me is that norms are falling. More dads are on playgrounds. More women are – I remember Elizabeth Warren was saying how fantastic it is. There's a women's bathroom in the Senate now.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
I mean, this is the evolution. This is what's happening. And our younger generation is learning this. I feel that way. I do believe that for the same reason my children 30 years from now are going to look at – the gay rights issue now and wonder what in God's name was the problem. And for the same reason, when you think about women have been voting for less than 100 years. True democracy has only been around for a scintilla of a moment, and that's just a staggering thing to think about. So progress is happening. And I think it's inevitable, but that doesn't mean we can't do what we can to push it along as best we can.
Ann Arbor-based Doug French is a blogger, father, and co-founder of the Dad 2.0 Summit. Doug, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Find out more on this story and others at MichiganRadio.org and tell us what you think.
This is the future.
You built a time machine out of a DeLorean?
It's alive, it's alive!
It's the sound of science!
We know our taste buds help steer us towards foods we like and away from things that might not be safe for us to eat. But some interesting new research suggests your sense of taste might actually affect how long you live. Scott Pletcher is one of these researchers looking into this. He's with the Department of Molecular and Integrative Physiology, also the Institute of Gerontology at the University of Michigan. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
So, Scott, what led you to make this connection that our sense of taste could actually play a role in our length of life?
For some years now, we've been interested in studying how sensory experiences can impact the behavior of organisms. And we noticed that not only did it impact their behavior, but it affected their physiology, their health as well. And so then we began to look at how it affected their lifespan and their patterns of aging.
So what did you find in terms of taste?
So one of the things that we found recently is that there's a couple different aspects of taste that impact their lifespan. One is a strange one, the taste of water. It turns out that humans and mammals and other organisms like fruit flies can taste water. And alternatively, we've also identified taste receptors that are important for detecting the opposite sex. So for males detecting females, for example.
And you're doing this in fruit flies.
Correct. Fruit flies are a very powerful and popular model system for studying aging because they live about 2 months, whereas mice live 3 to 4 years. And of course, we live much longer.
I have to ask, how can you tell whether a fruit fly can taste water?
Well, you can give them a choice between water and other types of bitter substances, for example, and you can find that they prefer that over something that tastes bad, for example. You can also identify the activity of neurons that are important in tasting water, and these respond to the animals sort of sticking their proboscis, is what it's called, into the water itself.
Fascinating. And you actually, did I read this correctly, that fruit flies that lose the ability to taste water actually live longer than those who can?
Correct. In this particular case, it turns out that the animals are responding to a perceived scarcity of water.
Mm-hmm.
And in so doing, they likely utilize their fat reserves to make water that they perceive as absent. And this results in them being healthier.
Now, you have been looking at, in other areas where sensory perception influences health, such as athletic performance and type 2 diabetes. But I also saw you've done research on how on these fruit flies that revealed some intriguing findings in terms of sexual activity, in terms of how much, how little. What was that about?
Right. So we found that when males were able to perceive females, and it turns out in fruit flies they do this by tasting compounds on the female. When they're able to do this, their lifespan is severely shortened and their health is severely compromised, presumably because they are undergoing physiological changes in the expectation of reproduction or some other sorts of behaviors they predict with females.
So they're sexually frustrated.
It could be, although, yeah, we're a little hesitant to say that. However, when the animals are actually allowed to mate, the effects of that taste go away. And so there is some balance between their expectation by sensory perception and what's actually realized by behavior.
Now, how do you take all of this and translate this information and the findings you've had in your work with the fruit flies? How can you translate that into human and advice to give humans for aging and healthier aging?
Right. This is an excellent question. The normal way this is done is by first moving into a system that is a little bit closer to us, mm-hmm. like mice. For example, our colleagues in California have just shown that manipulating a pain receptor, another sensory receptor in mice, extends their lifespan. And so the fruit fly and other simple model organisms have proven very successful in translating those findings into mammals, particularly mice. And those experiments are ongoing. How that translates into humans is really unclear. I think epidemiologists can study patterns of feeding behaviors in different populations and ask whether there's a correlation there. But actually doing the types of experiments to make them live longer, I think We need to get the mouse results.
That's down the research road
a little bit downstream. Yes,
but it does give us a sense the work you've done that these sensory perceptions that we have are really doing more than just we can smell this or taste that, but it really is impacting how the body works.
I think that's right. You may be familiar with the large brain initiative that the government is putting forward, and it turns out that the brain is, as we all know, sort of a master control system, and its influences are much greater than we imagined. And the sensory system is viewed as the window, the brain's window to the world. And what we're seeing is that simple, I guess, experiences that we've taken for granted for many years are actually interpreted by the brain and induce dramatic changes in us physiologically. I think you can relate to that if you're hungry and you smell a hot apple pie, your stomach churns, you can feel this sort of a thing. And what we're realizing now is that it's not just a short-term thing, but maybe it has long-term consequences.
Scott Pletcher, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
That was Scott Pletcher. He's with the Department of Molecular and Integrative Physiology and the Institute of Gerontology at the University of Michigan. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. A third grade teacher at Keith Elementary School in Walled Lake has been named Michigan Teacher of the Year. Melody Arabu joins us now. Congratulations, Melody.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
What do you think you do that has led you to be named Teacher of the Year in Michigan?
Well, I think building those relationships is key. I think no matter what grade level you teach, no matter what environment you are, what area you teach in, making a connection with the kids and making them feel welcome at school, making them feel excited to be at school, and then helping to build their confidence and see themselves as learners, no matter what their abilities are, or their struggles are. I think that's probably the most important thing.
What does that look like? How do you do that? Give us an example of the way you make this work in your classroom.
Sure. Well, I think that showing an interest in the students and in their personal lives, you know, I can tell you what sport each of the kids are really good at and what they love. I can tell you about their hobbies. They can actually tell you about mine. You know, we do a lot of team building in the class and just a lot of conversations and a lot of activities that help us really get to know each other. And I actually tell them that we're a family here and we try to work towards that family feeling from the first week of school.
And what about in Michigan in 2014, what do you see as the biggest challenges facing Michigan's teachers?
Well, the implementation of the Common Core, I know, is something that teachers are apprehensive about, but at the same time, I know that we've embraced it and we see the value in it. And so we are all making changes to make that just part of our everyday norm. And also, you know, there's a lot of anxiety about teacher evaluations and the way that things are put in place in the district and through the state. But again, that's something that, you know, is new and a little bit uncomfortable. But as we've been going through it for the last couple of years, I think that people are becoming more comfortable with it. And I do think also seeing the value in it.
And as Michigan's Teacher of the Year, you get to be at the monthly meetings of the State Board of Education, so you are going to be able to basically bring the view from the front line.
I do. I'm excited to see how that works and learn more about the political atmosphere around education, and then to be able to bring the voice of the teachers that I know and the concerns that we have and the celebrations that we have so that we can, you know, uplift the public education system.
Melody Arabu is Michigan's Teacher of the Year. She teaches the third grade at Keith Elementary School in Walled Lake. Congratulations again, Melody, and thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much. It's an honor. Thanks for having me.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. You've been living on the streets, going from shelter to shelter. The ties that bind you to society have been cut one by one. You don't have a driver's license. You haven't been working. You have no idea where your birth certificate is, and you don't have a social security number. You can't find the card. But you want to begin getting your life together again. And for that, you need legal ID. Without ID, you can't get a job. You certainly can't cash a check or apply for food stamps. You can't vote. You can't rent housing. Advocates for the homeless say getting a state ID card in Michigan is way too complicated. Elizabeth Kelly is with Hope Hospitality and Warming Center in Pontiac. Welcome to the program, Elizabeth.
Thank you, Cynthia. Nice to be here.
And we're joined by Greg Marcus, who's a founding organizer of the Detroit Action Commonwealth, as well as a brand newly retired professor with the Institute for Social Research at the University of Michigan. So good to have you with us, Greg.
Thank you.
Give us a sense, Elizabeth, how big a problem is this legal ID issue when you see homeless people come in to the Hope Hospitality and Warming Center?
Well, it actually is a huge issue. Most people do not have ID. They can become separated from all of their important documents. So they don't have a birth certificate, they don't have a social security card, and they don't have ID. And in order to get a social security card, you need an ID. And in order to get an ID, you need a social security card. And so there's a conundrum right there.
Hello, Catch 22. Gregor, give me an idea as you work with homeless people in Detroit. Go take us deeper into the kind of obstacles they face when they try to get off this Catch 22 treadmill.
My students and I went to soup kitchens in Detroit starting about 7 years ago. We met around the tables at mealtime with folks who come to the soup kitchen to explore whether it might be possible to form an organization of low-income, no-income homeless people. Mm-hmm. And so we simply sat around and talked with them and asked them what are some of the challenges they face and how might we go about solving these problems together. And the ID problem was clearly at the top of the list, the very first thing that many of the folks at the soup kitchens told us about. And I had no idea about this. There are literally thousands and thousands and thousands of native-born Detroiters mm-hmm. who have no ID and have had no practical means of getting ID.
Elizabeth, give us an idea then. What doors are closed as someone tries to get through this and crack through whatever hurdles are there to get the ID? What do they encounter?
There's a lot of documentation that you have to bring. So you would expect a social security card and a birth certificate to be core identity documents that you would need to bring. Mm-hmm. But then they will ask for random things like a high school transcript. You have to bring, if you don't have your name on a lease or you don't have utility bills because you're homeless, you have to bring mail that has the address. But then what's in the mail is equally important. And then things you think might count towards it, like a bridge card, which would show you were homeless, or an identity card from the Homeless Management Information System, which is a HUD database, and it's a photo ID, doesn't count at all. So they have this paper chase that's absolutely incredible. And without an ID, you can't open a bank account. You can't get medical help. You can't do pretty much anything. You can't qualify for housing through housing agencies. You have to have that to be able to move forward. You can't get a job. All of these things are contingent on having a valid ID.
Now, we do need to talk some about why we all have to jump through hoops to get a state ID card. We know that lax standards and sloppiness let the 9/11 hijackers get visas into this country, and some of those hijackers were able to fraudulently obtain state IDs. So across the country, state and federal governments have tightened the rules for security. So how do we strike that balance between Homeland Security and helping someone who's homeless get state ID? I guess who wants to try that one?
I would say that really is also another conundrum that we have to be able to manage. It's very difficult, though, if you don't have transportation and you're asked to go back to the Secretary of State multiple times. We had a man in the shelter who actually had his original birth certificate from 1956 and his Social Security card probably from when he was a small child, because he was well-educated, but he had cancer, which he lost his job, lost his home, and became homeless. He was pretty high-functioning. He went back three times in order to be able to get an ID because they didn't accept correspondence at the time from the Department of Human Services. They had to send everything that we brought with us to help prove who he was mm-hmm. in addition to a special exceptions unit. And I've heard from people, there was a friend of mine who moved here from Missouri, and he said he brought a passport, his Missouri driver's license, his Social Security card, his birth certificate, and his mortgage papers. And they asked him why he wasn't on the utility bills, which his wife had opened the utilities up. And they were leaning towards denying him a driver's license. So sometimes the pendulum swings too far. Some of the things that they require as documentation, like a high school transcript, in the case of one of our shelter guests, I emailed the contact us section of the district website, and they faxed it over to me within about 15 minutes with no other communication other than me saying I'm the representative for this particular individual. Other districts will charge money for this, which then becomes another barrier if you have no money.
Now, Greg, the Michigan Secretary of State's office was quoted as saying that they'll accept a verifying letter from a shelter in lieu of two pieces of ID. Are we seeing that work? Is that happening across the board? And is that – oh, you're shaking your head, Elizabeth. Nuh-uh. That's not true?
We've given them shelter – it depends on who they get. And they're more apt to have to still send it to the special exceptions unit, which can delay it up to 2 weeks, and then you have to come back again.
And we understand, too, that some of these tightened restrictions are to help fight identity fraud. Social Security numbers are very, very important. So, again, there's that balance because we understand why we need to be very demanding as a government as far as who's getting cards and what's done with those numbers. Again, where does that balance happen?
Look, I'm a political scientist. I understand and I fully understand the rationale behind the tightened up requirements. Mm-hmm. The problem is there's a need for a little more sensitivity and empathy towards the kinds of problems that that homeless people, no-income folks face. You mentioned about this, well, we'll accept a letter from a homeless shelter. We had a fight for that. That was not anything automatic. That was a political battle to grudgingly, I'm sorry to say, get that kind of agreement. The Michigan state law explicitly provides for the Secretary of State to waive the fee for an ID if the applicant, and this is the language, can show good cause. We met with representatives of the Secretary of State at the soup kitchen, our organization did, and explained to them that, well, one good cause for waiving the fee is if a person is indigent and has no money and can't get any money until they get an ID card and then can get a job and get on their feet.
Sure.
We asked them, do they ever waive the fee for indigent folks? And the answer we got was no. I asked, have they ever waived the fee for any other reason? And I was at this meeting. This is not hearsay. The regional representatives of the Secretary of State's office told us, well, yes, we have waived the fee for university students when they come in and they need to get their ID prior to traveling abroad. And, you know, university students don't carry cash with them. They just have debit cards, and we don't accept debit cards. So we have waived fees for university students, but no, we won't waive fees for an indigent person who's applying for an ID so that they can get a job.
Door slammed.
Yes. And so we tried to negotiate this. We finally had to file suit against the Secretary of State. Then they sat down and talked with us, and then they established a new policy that for certain cases, if you're receiving cash benefits, so if you're getting cash welfare, SSI, cash support, disability income, if you're low income but receiving cash and you present those documents, they will waive the fee. This still leaves out the large majority of folks who are indigent and get no cash benefits, but at least it's a beginning. There are ways around some of these problems, and it depends on who you happen to,
who you turn up in line
with. And again, I'm speaking from experience at the offices. My students and I have personally accompanied more than 1,000 individuals to the counters at Secretary of State offices, Social Security offices, and school transcript offices and such to collect these documents. In some cases, one woman I worked with, it was a two-year process to finally draw together all of the – she was born in rural South Carolina back in the early 1950s. She was born at home. There was no birth certificate. She had no other documents and so forth. It was, so in the Social Security office, and if you call the Social Security Administration, they would say, oh, we have a way around this. You can provide these other many documents and such. They do have a way around it. It's a very difficult way around it, number one. Mm-hmm. Number two, many of the clerks at the offices are not aware of these alternative policies. And that's the same at the Secretary of State office. They don't know.
Yeah.
So when I took a gentleman to the Social Security office a few weeks ago, knowing what the rules were and such, and that he needed a printout or a replacement card, the clerk said, show us your Michigan ID, show us your state ID. Mm-hmm. We said, we don't have one. That's why we're here. She said, there's nothing more we can do for you. Sorry. Goodbye.
Elizabeth, what's the price we pay as a state and a society if we don't fix this?
Well, it's very high. I mean, you keep people permanently homeless. They're drifting in and out of shelters. Many of them will panhandle at the least and maybe do other things in order to be able to try to make ends meet. And it's not fair. when it comes to society, you know, as Greg said, how we handle the and take care of those that have the greatest need defines us. As a society, this is something that should not be tolerated.
Elizabeth Kelly is the executive director of the Hope Hospitality and Warming Center in Pontiac. Greg Marcus is the founding organizer of the Detroit Action Commonwealth and a newly retired professor of political science who's been with the Institute for Social Research at the University of Michigan. Thank you so much to both of you for talking with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
Thank you.
When you close your eyes and you think of an alley, what do you see? Trash? Junky cars? Or a place where danger lurks? Or do you see a place where people might stroll, perhaps car-free, certainly cleaned up? That's what my next guest sees. She is president of Midtown Detroit Incorporated, a nonprofit community development group that's working to transform gritty urban alleys in Midtown Detroit into something that's green, something you'd want to walk through, and something that helps with urban revitalization. Sue Mosey, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Why should we even think about alleys at all, except as places to maybe cut through by car and avoid if by foot?
Well, I think in an area like Midtown in Detroit, I mean, it was pretty much out of necessity that we decided we needed to take some action on a lot of the alleys in the neighborhood. First of all, a lot of them were in very poor condition. Some of them were actually collapsing. And so we've been working with the DPW department to do some of the underground repairs. And then since we were going to have to redo them anyway, we figured why not make them green and sustainable and beautiful? Why not make them attractive for pedestrians and bicyclists? Why not make them community spaces for potluck dinners or art exhibitions? And so the community really rallied around this. And we did our first demonstration one with the folks that put together the Green Garage, which is a small green business incubator in Midtown. Mm-hmm. And that was combination effort. We raised the money. They brought in a lot of the volunteer effort. We both worked with the city to really get their support for this kind of a new concept and, you know, a new kind of way to deal with some of these alleys in the neighborhood. And it all turned into a beautiful space. So after we did that one, we thought, well, now there's a number of other new developments coming into the area. They all have alleys sitting next to them. They're all in poor condition, and they have to be addressed if we want the surrounding developments to be successful, and we really want to leverage everyone's investment. So then we picked a second alley that's now under construction, kind of a really large one, much more expensive project, but we think it's going to leverage a lot of benefits for the neighborhood.
What kind of cost are we looking at to take a, well, a, you know, cruddy alley and make it something green and lovely?
Yeah, I mean, you can do a lot of different models. I mean, the first one we did, because there was a lot of volunteer manpower in it, and we were paying for, you know, pavers, we were paying for some of the landscaping, but the volunteers really, you know, did most of the landscaping work. We paid for induction lighting, and, you know, some other features. That one was really kind of a half an alley. It really didn't go the entire block, and that was about $75,000. The alley we're doing now is about $400,000. It's a much longer, wider alley, and we're paying for that with foundation funding, and we have a matching grant from Shinola, who are, you know, manufacturing in the neighborhood here, and they're also committed to this whole green alley concept throughout the district. So,
and Sue, when you think of alleys and the little garages that, that go up and down them all through Detroit, what makes that special from an urban planning and urban revitalization standpoint?
Well, I think the best thing is the scale. I mean, people really like to be in attractive, more intimate scale places. And this gives you an opportunity to do that. And I think it's an opportunity to reuse something that's, you know, usually seen as more of a negative, and just create something that's unexpected and really positive. And people really respond to that. You know, reusing old spaces in new ways, I mean, it doesn't really get better than that.
Sue Mosey, president of Midtown Detroit Incorporated, a nonprofit community development group that is working to transform alleys in Midtown Detroit. Thanks for talking with us, Sue.
Okay, thank you.
It was a long, hot haul, but he did it. 14-year-old Hunter Grandy completed his 40-mile walk from his junior high school building in Temperance to the University of Michigan campus this past weekend. He carried his 7-year-old brother, Braden, on his back for every single step. It was called the Cerebral Palsy Swagger. Braden was born with CP, and his big brother had hoped their walk would focus attention on cerebral palsy. He especially wanted to challenge engineers and doctors to seek improvements in mobility for those who live with CP. As Hunter told us last week on Stateside, his little brother's walker doesn't do well in sand or gravel, so Braden's often forced to sit on the sidelines during recess at school. And Hunter doesn't think that's right. That cerebral palsy swagger made headlines around the nation and overseas. Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer was Peg Watson. Support for the Detroit Journalism Cooperative comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation and the Ford Foundation. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.